Okay, as I mentioned earlier, our topic tonight is, so you want to be an independent consultant. Alex Brown is our presenter this evening. After 13 years as an employee, he started his own company, Real Life Projects Incorporated. Before he embarked on this endeavor, though, he did a lot of research and consulting with many project management consultants. And has built his company around multiple products and business models, consulting, training, and public speaking. He is a frequent speaker at PMI events all over the world and is known for his practical, down-to-earth advice about project management. And he promises that he will give you direct answers to all your questions in this session. Please join me in welcoming Alex Brown.
Okay, everybody. I want to give you all a warning first to start. First of all, can you hear me in the back? Is this volume okay? All right, cool. I'm not going to bother with a microphone. One thing that I'm going to do here is I'm going to give you a brief introduction to myself. And I've got a bunch of slides and stuff prepared if none of you have any questions. But it's actually really rare to get an opportunity to ask somebody who's been a consultant about their business. So I'd rather open it up to the floor and answer any questions that you have. So I'm going to do a brief intro, but think about what questions you have. What are the things that you've always wanted to know about what it's like to go from being a regular employee to being a consultant, or what it's like to try and build your business as a consultant? Any questions at all, it's all fair game. I've got the handout that you've all got in front of you. That maybe will spark some ideas, I don't know. But again, a little bit of an unconventional kind of presentation tonight, a lot more Q&A. So let me start first by telling you a kind of a story. And it's a strange story because it's a story of how I almost didn't show up here to give you this presentation. About a month ago, and this is early December, I sat down and I opened up my bank statement. And I looked at the figures on my bank statement, and I said, oh my gosh, how am I going to pay February's mortgage? I looked at the state of my business, I looked at the state of my personal finances, and I said, how can I come in front of this group and present myself as an expert in consulting when my business is like this? I said, will I even be able to stay a consultant? And this led to some really serious, I'm not joking, this is tough situation. I tend to get stressed about things, and it's like I was shaking like a leaf. I just said, forget it, I'm not going to make any phone calls today, I'm not going to try to do any business. Let me just figure this stuff out. And the following day, I sat down, I had some conversations with my wife. We figured out, how are we going to do this? How can we make this work? What are the best choices? Should I go back to being a regular employee, or should I try and keep this company going? And it was interesting because we both sat down and we both came to the same conclusion, which was that being a consultant and keeping the company going was in the long term going to be much better for us than me going back to being an employee. So if you had called me on that morning in December when I had first opened the bank statement and I had that terror in my heart, I would have said, nope, I am not going to go to New York City and give people advice on how it is to be a consultant. But the day after, when I kind of renewed myself and thought about why I did this, I was willing to say, yeah, this is something I do want to do. I do want to share my passion. There's a great speaker, a group I've gotten involved with, the National Speakers Association, led me to meet a guy named Mark LeBlanc. And he's got kind of a signature phrase that he says about his business as a speaker. He says, I've given up 1,000 times. I've given up on my business completely 1,000 times. And the only reason I'm here before you today is because I decided to start up my business again 1,001 times. Now, I'm not as great a man as Mark LeBlanc. I think I've only given up on my business between 5 and 10 times. But one more time than that, I've decided, no, I do want to give this a go. I do want to make this happen. I do want to make this work. So for anybody who is a faint of heart and saying, maybe I want to be a consultant, maybe I don't, you're kind of in that maybe area, part of my goal here today is to get you off that fence and decide, it's a yes or it's a no. Maybe will not get you through times like I had a month ago. maybe will not get you past those times. You need a passion. You need something that's going to drive you to make those choices and to do those things. Another note I want to make is I'll talk some about my experience. And this is just my experience. This is what I've done and what's worked for me. It might not work for you. This is one of the crazy things I've learned. You will run into lots of people who tell you, this is the way to be a consultant. This is the way to succeed in business. Anybody who says that to me now, I ignore them. Because I know all it is that they're talking about is what has worked for them. And there are things about their business and things about their marketplace that may not work for me at all. So I'm going to come up and give you some advice. I'm going to say, I think this was one of the greatest things I did. And for some of you, it would be the worst mistake in the world for you to copy that. So just keep that in mind. Also, I'm not going to give any legal or accounting advice. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an accountant. So that standard disclaimer, you know, consult with an attorney or a lawyer, very much applies to anything you hear here. But let me kind of give you my background. About 13 years ago, I started as a project manager. I didn't even know what a project manager was, but looking back, I know that's the job I was doing. I was running software projects. I was working with salespeople. I was working with marketing people. I was going out and giving product demos. I've loved these projectors my whole career because I'm always up here showing off software and explaining how things work. Ironically, it's only the last 2 years I've learned how to get away from them and just do storytelling like this. But what I did is I went through a lot of different companies, Automatic Data Processing, Merrill Lynch, Chubb Insurance, always working as an employee project manager. But I always found I was the person doing weird stuff at the company. There was something strange going on at the company. If it was a one-product company, I was the person to the side doing the new product, doing the second product. So I kind of had a consulting relationship a lot. I worked with a lot of consultants. In fact, I ran into one consultant along the way who kind of inspired me. I loved her lifestyle. I loved her approach to the business. And I said, I want to be like her. I want to be like this woman because she's got a great career and a great balance. And actually, I thought I could never do that. And one time I shared that self-doubt with her, and she said, Alex, you could do this. You just have to decide you're going to. So that's a words of inspiration that kept with me a long time. But so eventually what happened, I was working for a company called Mitsui Sumitomo. I was the strategic planning office manager there. Some of you have heard all about that in some previous stories that I've done here for the New York chapter. I won't go into the details of it, but basically I got to a point in the job where I realized the company wasn't that big and they were downsizing somewhat. They needed to keep their costs down. And I tried to think, what's the best way for them to keep their costs down? I realized within my office was just me, it was a one-person office, one of the best ways they could keep their costs down would be to fire me and replace me with somebody who probably costs about half as much as I do in terms of salary. And they could get away with that. They could get a lot of their core functions still met that way. And I realized I kind of had a decision to make. I knew this. My boss wasn't enough of a technical project manager to know that. And he didn't necessarily have advisors who would tell him that. So was I going to share this with them? Was I going to share this business plan with them? And I thought about it for a while, and I'd been thinking about going out on my own and doing consulting. And in fact, I think what really pushed it over the edge is I started doing an interview with a consulting company to possibly be a mid to senior level consultant for them, responsible for bringing in business as well as overseeing projects. And I just said this, I have to go to them with this. I have to go to them with essentially a consulting proposal. So I walked into the president of the company's office, and I put in front of him a proposal, and I said, this is what I think you should do. I think you should fire me, hire somebody in who's got maybe 3 to 5 years experience, and keep me on as a part-time consultant. Bring me in to bring that person up to speed, and you'll probably only need me at most 3 days a month, maybe a week per month, to still really keep things going at a high quality in the company. A lot of people told me this was a really stupid idea, as you can imagine. A lot of people told me I was crazy to give up a job that had, you know, decent benefits. It was with a nice Japanese company. The job security was really pretty high there. I don't think they would have fired me. But to say, let me jump off that cliff. And ideally, they would have been my first client, but it didn't work out that way. A lot of people there felt, I think, betrayed by me even coming up with a proposal like this. A couple of them didn't want anything to do with me after that. Some of them asked me to stay, tried to persuade me, no, come on, come back. But in the end, I wound up saying, no, this is my future. And I went out on my own to become an independent consultant. So, of course, the first thing I did was hunt for clients, because there's no money coming in all of a sudden. And I wound up doing a variety of different things. I can get into some of the details of it, but at this point, I've got training services that I provide in the project management area. I do consulting work, so I'll come in and help people set up a project management office or help them rationalize their project management office, things like that. And I'm even developing some products and services that would work with the small business community, which is an area I see kind of neglected. I don't see a lot of project managers operating with businesses, say, under 100 people. And certainly none of them working with, like, you know, truly micro businesses, like one person to five person businesses. So I'm kind of exploring some different areas in that. So that's kind of been my experience and my background. And what I'd really love to do is just open it up to you guys and ask, what do you want to know about consulting? Because I spent a lot of time researching before I jumped into this. I actually led a discussion group kind of like this before the PMI Asia Pacific Congress in Sydney, where we had four consultants up here, and they were all able to answer different questions about their consulting practice. All of them were, I think, at least 10 years in the consulting realm. And here I was, the moderator. When I first agreed to be the moderator, I wasn't a consultant myself, but it so happens that all this happened at the same time. By the time we actually came and gave the presentation, I was also a consultant. But I learned so much from them. So I've got my perspective. I can also share with you ideas I picked up along the way. So any questions?
Hi, Shoot. Yes. I think branding is extremely important, and I know as an IT PM that we need to brand and rebrand over and over again to keep up with the latest IT trends. So I guess my question to you is, would you go to an outside service for, you can certainly, you know, would you go to an outside service, a marketing company or something to set up your identity and your websites and all this stuff? So branding, can you talk about that for a minute and how important it is and how to go about it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, I'm just curious, when somebody says branding, like, what do you think when you're saying branding? What is branding to you?
You have to know what you're selling, and you have to, everything that you say and do needs to talk about what you do. It's in your elevator speech.
Right.
It's how you sell yourself, what you're selling, logos.
Yeah.
On the marketing end. Branding.
And those are good definitions and good examples. The thing, to me, what branding is branding is, it's kind of who you are and what you do. What's new and different that you offer to the marketplace? Now, I think sometimes for some people, going out to an outside firm would be really smart and a really good idea, and that may be a way that they could develop a brand and create logos around the brand. I know for me personally, if I tried to go to an outside service, it would have been a terrible kind of mishmash, because I didn't have the information they would have needed to come up with a brand. I kind of had to discover this by myself. And actually, the one thing that kept me from starting a consulting firm, from going out on my own in the past, was I knew I was terrified of marketing and sales. I was terrified at the idea of saying, "Hi, my name's Alex Brown, and I'd like you to pay X amount of money to me for this service." Just saying that would have just sent me under the covers and said, oh my God, I can't do this. So for me, I went through it, you know, kind of self-help. I bought books, I bought manuals, you got some of the references listed in your book, but I did it all by myself. I would recommend that probably for most people, in part because it can get really expensive. A lot of it depends, too, on how much money you have to start.
Alex?
Yeah, sure.
What were your 3 to 5 things that you did after you kind of realized this is the direction I want to go into, and you took that deep breath and you forged forward?
Yeah, I think the main thing that I did first that was probably most important is I sat down and I came up with a business plan. So I sat down and I said, how many months would it take me to build the base that I want to? I visualized where I wanted my company to be in 6 months, in 12 months, in 18 months. And I also looked at cash flow. I looked at how much money we had saved away to make sure that we could be viable. I could be viable as a family all the way through there. I'm the sole breadwinner in my family, so there's no other income coming in. So that was really key for me. So I kind of sat down and I said, well, what business plan do I want? How do I visualize this happening? And then I started to think, do I have the skills and expertise to do that myself? And there are some parts where I really didn't. I developed my own skills to some extent, or I found other people who could help me. But I think that's one of the main things I think you need to do. You don't want to jump right into it. Actually, it's funny. I don't know if anybody got the December PM Network. There was an article in here that's got some kind of, it's called Opportunity Knots. And it was Roberto Toledo gives you like a step-by-step guide towards coming up with, towards getting started as a consultant. And I thought this was hilarious because he says one thing about thinking about cash flow and savings, and he says make sure you have at least 3 months in the bank. I thought that was really fun because I would have been out of this a long time ago if I only had 3 months in the bank. It's been more like 12 to 18 months in the bank. That we needed in order to do. It depends on what business you want to start. There's no one rule that says you need so much cash. It depends on the business.
You didn't find yourself getting stuck in the mechanics of setting up an LLC or an S corporation or...
Yeah, another thing I recommend, and this is what I did with to set up the corporation, I had the corporation set up a year and a half before that.
Okay.
So I had done one consulting gig. There was a friend of mine who really needed Microsoft project training in his company, and he says, Alex, would you come in here and do this for us? And he talked to other commercial companies, and they didn't make sense for him. So I came in and did the work for him, and I already set up myself as a corporation ahead of time. And that actually is another thing that I think probably one of the biggest mistakes I made is I didn't set up some things like insurance ahead of time. I really wish I had gotten things like a line of credit on my home before I had started the business. Because some of these things become very difficult when you have no income. Talk to your insurance agent. Talk to your financial advisor and see what makes sense to do while I still have income. Because as soon as you cross that line and now you're out and your income is based on the profit of your own company, some companies, like insurance companies, look at you completely differently. But if you have a policy in force, you may be able to keep it in force just by making payments. So you want to think about all those issues before you get started. I thought on the business side pretty well. I don't think I thought on the insurance side as well as I could have. So you got a question in the back.
As a consultant, is it more difficult for you to get up and manage support for your projects as opposed to being an employee?
So is it more difficult to get a...
Upper management support for your projects. How do you develop a strategy?
Well, I guess it depends. You mean internal projects or you mean external projects? Because for me, internal projects are really easy to get upper management support because that's me. It's kind of scary, too, actually. You can do some really stupid things if you're not careful because you have no checks and balances against what you want to do. One of the things that I like about being a consultant when I'm working with clients is I think I usually get higher level access than I would if I was an employee. And that's in part because of the selling cycle. If I can't get through to a senior level manager, I need to find somebody who has enough budget, who has enough authority to hire me. So if they can't afford my fee, it doesn't make sense for me to talk to them, at least initially. I need to get approval from those people to bring me in. They have to believe in me before I get started. And then when I do my day-to-day work in a PMO or in a training situation, most of the people I work with don't have that level of authority. But I've still got that sponsor back. And I have to keep a relationship with them, otherwise I don't continue to work there. So it's very different than being an employee, though. You got another?
Okay, Alex. I was on the other side of the fence. I consulted 14 years, yeah. Then I took a dive into the employment side for 4 years. And one thing I learned from my past experience that I would love to correct going forward is I could never keep my personal and my work life in balance in terms of if I take a day off, it really goes off my income.
Yes,
even if I could afford it. As an employee, the luxury of paid vacation kicked in. Now looking forward, if I decide to jump into consulting again, how did you manage that? How do you really manage convincing yourself to take a day off?
I'm just curious. You've been through both. The paid vacation is nice. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, the freedom is nice too. Which do you have a preference yet?
I am going back as soon as I can, absolutely.
You're going back to the consultant?
And I feel
the same way in a lot of ways because, well, you know, you say, how do I convince myself to take a day off? Well, actually, one of the things that I did is I sat down and came up with my own holiday calendar. And I gave myself certain holidays. For instance, I've never been much around New Year's Day and so forth. So I work in the week between Christmas and New Year's. I almost always have. I don't take a lot of time off from there. But on the other hand, I'm home most days. If I'm not out working for a client, I'm in my home, and my kids and my family are just outside the door. That has pluses and minuses,
sure.
As you can imagine. But for a lot of things, that's very good, and that's very nice. But I have my own holiday calendar. I take off Martin Luther King Jr. because I think that's important, and that's something I value.
It's a good fact.
But I built that in.
Actually, I'd like to ask him a question. He was very adamant. Well, your last line was, I'm going back to being a consultant. Mm-hmm. And you said that with a smile. Why are you so firm on doing that?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons, but one sticks out in my mind is, one of the reasons I wanted to become an employee is to climb the ladder. I wanted to experience that idea of being promoted and going up, up, up.
Yeah, it sticks at the top.
Right. Consulting, I was at the top, but I always felt I'm like illegit. I'm not really reporting to the CIO. I tried that now. Last 4 years, I reported to the highest officer in the company. But one of the things I miss immensely is the challenge that your bread and butter is on the line for. And honestly, as an employee, you tend to slow down, you tend to take it a little bit easier. And I used to look at people who are employees and say, how can anybody like be that easy about their development, their challenges in career? So that's one thing bringing back consulting. There is an element of excitement that if you're 21, it's one type of excitement. If you're 38, it's a whole different level. So that is one thing I miss immensely in consulting. And for the first time I realized, you actually have your hands cuffed when you're an employee. There are certain paradigms you can never break through.
Well, that's interesting. There are times your hands are cuffed as a consultant, too.
Absolutely. And I remember that very well, but I would trade that cuff for this cuff. That cuff was a challenge you could actually overcome. It becomes part of what you are working towards or against. As an employee, that cuff is almost like a discipline you have to like live by and convince yourself not to clash with. So for me, personality-wise, employment was a tough one.
I wanted to add to that because I think a number of people who actually want to go into consulting, they've been maybe at companies and they're tired. They're tired of having to follow policies that maybe they don't believe in,
right.
Having to run projects that are disastrous yet they can't walk away from, or bringing in billable hours when you really don't feel that it's necessary anymore.
That's one of the kinds of the fun things about it is I can sit down and I can say, I won't accept certain types of business. If there's a client that I don't like working with, I can say, you know, I won't work for you anymore. Of course, on the bad side is if I won't do that business, I won't get paid. I won't eat. I won't pay for the roof over my head. There's that threat as well. But as long as you have... You need to have a kind of an abundance mentality, I think. At least that's something a lot of people say that, but I don't think I really understood that until I got into the consulting realm. You know, it's not until your money's running out and you still have that feeling that there's good business out there, there's people who need me, and I can still go out and find them. it's not until your money's running down you still feel that way, that you really understand this idea of abundance, that there's more out there. Let's go in the back.
Did you have any formal or informal advisors to provide you with objective advice or someone you could bounce ideas off of? And what's your opinion about having those type of people around you?
Yeah, actually, having formal advisors is something that I strongly, strongly recommend. It's interesting. The four panelists that I worked with in Sydney, I was bouncing ideas off of them all the time. I signed up for this Info Guru marketing book, and the book is okay. What was much more valuable was the online discussion area that came with it. I started reaching out and forming informal networks of people with whom I could have conversations about things that I was really very uncomfortable with or didn't know much about. I've also had coaches. I've had a paid coach. One of them actually I found through the Info Guru website. We've developed a relationship there, and eventually I said, look, I want more of your time. Let me start paying you for some of that time. I really strongly recommend having some advisors. If you really feel like you're alone and you don't know anybody who's been doing this, solve that before you actually go out on your own. Find your network of consultants, people who do business like you would want to do business. That was another thing that I hated about calling myself a consultant, that I knew a lot of terrible consultants, people I would never want to emulate. People, I hated their sales styles, I hated their marketing styles, I hated their businesses. But I had to find the people who I admired and would want to emulate before I could go out on my own. I think that's one of the smart things I did. I found that group, and I borrowed little bits and pieces from them. Let me sit back over here.
Once you've found some clients, how do you persuade them to agree to pay you, and then how do you make sure that they do?
Ah, that's an interesting one. And actually, and I've had some clients who have not yet paid. So that's it's a very good question. One thing that I think is probably I think there's two things that you probably have a misconception of if you've never been a consultant. The first thing is that people will be unwilling to pay you. If you can solve a legitimate business problem for someone, and you can find the right person in the organization, the person with the budget authority to solve it, they will pay you. And they'll pay you a lot more than you think that they're going to pay you. What I would get paid as an employee, my billing rate is substantially higher than that. Because everybody knows I need to cover the days that I am not working with them, the marketing time that it takes to get a client like that. So if you talk around to other consultants, you can find out what legitimate rates are in your area of expertise, but probably higher than you think. The second thing that you probably have a misconception about is that if it's in the contract, then you're going to get paid for it. It doesn't always happen. Just because you sign a contract with them and it's dotted and you've gone to your lawyer and their lawyer approves it and it says you're supposed to be paid so many $1,000s, doesn't mean you're actually going to be paid. So I've certainly gotten to the point where I look for things like advances, I look for partial payments up front, I look at what their history is of payment. Sometimes I'll go out and I'll try and find other vendors that they've worked with to make sure they do pay on time. And I also look very carefully in the contracts to see how quickly are they agreeing to pay. I'd much rather have a contract where they're going to pay me 30 days after the end of the month than something where I'm only allowed to bill them once a quarter and it's 90 days after the end of the quarter. And yes, I did one contract like the latter and I do not want to do that again because it did turn into some payment problems. Here.
Yes, when you do your consulting, when you win in consulting engagements, you're mostly marketing yourself, and then if your client needs, you know, your team, you get them to your client, or do you have people? Do you have people?
Yeah, I should have mentioned this. My model, and this isn't the right model, this is just my model. My model is I am my company, I am my team. I don't want lots of employees. But that's a lifestyle choice for me as much as anything else. I don't want the burden and the pressure of having other people's salaries dependent on me going out and getting more business. There are people who have the other types of models where they'll either bring in subcontractors or they'll have people on staff who's kind of a team who go out and do work on behalf of other people. I only know the sole consultant model in depth. That's the only one I ever did. But the research I've done into the other ones, and I could privately give you some of the pros and cons, but essentially the more people you take on, the more pressure you're putting on yourself. Because a lot of times you have to take out greater loans in order to float the salary that you're paying to other people. You run into problems where if the client doesn't pay you, can you pay your employees? And there's a lot of unpleasant things that I wanted to avoid. So I just stayed away from that model.
I had a question. With all these corporate layoffs and the economy with downturn and frozen headcount, corporations probably have easier money to obtain POs to get contracts short-term for consultants as opposed to with headcount. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I wish they had a lot of money for POs for consultants. I don't think... It depends on the company. I think one of the best things and the worst things about being a consultant is... You know, when you work for an employee, you're stuck in their industry. You're stuck with their strategic plan. So, if you're working for a pharmaceutical company, for instance, then you're stuck with what's going on with U.S. Congress and all the other issues in pharma. In my situation, I've had some pharma clients, and that's a tough space right now. There's not a lot going on. That's been very difficult for me to get the business in. So one of the things I did is I said, well, what's something that's related? Medical devices. Medical devices have a lot of the same needs as a pharma company, but medical device companies are economically very different, and they're not feeling a pinch the same way the pharma companies are. So I can start to market to them. So there's some flexibility. You're still concerned about the economy. You have to pick and choose your niche. And the really nice thing, though, is that the economy is really, really big. I just need a little bit of it to be really, really happy. You know, if I want to bill $1 million a year, for instance, what is that compared to, you know, the trillions of dollars that are going through the U.S. economy? That's nothing. That's nothing even of a small sector. I can pick a very small niche. As long as I can be very appealing in that niche, I can make a very good living for myself. So that's the kinds of things I focus on and think about, and I try to forget the economy issues. Got a question over here.
Yeah, I do have a question, but first I want to reply to him. From my experience as a VP in several companies, the first thing that goes when you have budget cuts is the consulting budget. So it's a tough, you know, justification. But my question to you is, what is your elevator speech? What's unique about you?
Oh, what's my elevator speech? This is a good one. Everybody know what an elevator speech is. This is like if somebody meets you in an elevator, you need 30 seconds to explain your company. What is it that you do? And for me, I've got different elevator speeches depending on who I'm talking to. If I was talking to a group like this, I would probably come in and say, you know, oh, my name's Alex. I do real life projects. What I do is I help companies that have got... issues going on in their project management discipline. Usually it's either they've got no processes and they have an audit coming up, or they've got too much process and they need to lighten it up in a sensible fashion. I help them find the right balance between heavy and formal and informal and effective. I help them bring that together. I don't know if that's convincing or not, but that's sort of my typical elevator speech.
How well did it work for you?
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And that's the reality of sales. You never know for sure. We were talking about this. You never know for sure if you have the right elevator pitch. And I've changed it many, many times in response to some different suggestions from people. Is there a question in the back?
You mentioned that one of your big fears was going out and telling people, here I am.
Yeah.
How did I overcome
the fear? Essentially, because it was a fear of selling. I mean, I'll be straight about it. This was a complete fear of selling. I am a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. My parents are, one's a history professor, the other's a lawyer. If you don't think I have hang-ups about sales, I don't know what to tell you. I've got tremendous hang-ups about sales. Sales were always presented as a negative thing in my house. A salesman was a negative person. The used car salesman is about as low as you can get on the spectrum of development. So what I started to do is, first of all, I went through and I did things like marketing. So I went through, and it's actually great. If you pick up something like, this is Jeffrey Ginnemer, great writer about sales. And I wound up talking to other people who are experts in sales. There's a woman who I work with in New Jersey, Karen Kopp, who's an expert on sales. And what I realized is a really good salesperson is not there to push something on you. A really good salesperson matches the right buyer to the right product. And if it's not the right product for the right buyer, they walk away. So I started investing in myself, and I started saying, what am I? Who can I help? So instead of going out to the marketplace and saying, hi, how are you? My name's Alex Brown. I'd like to sell you this thing. Come on, come on, come on. Let me see. Instead of that kind of attitude, which is what I was grown to expect salespeople do, instead I started saying, yeah, here I am. I'm Alex Brown. Let me help you with this. And once we started having a conversation about your problems, I'd say, all right, these are the things I want to do, but I'm going to need some time with your company. This is what it's going to cost. It was a very different kind of selling, different style of selling. And actually, I had some good salespeople that I worked with in the past. There was a guy, Chris Feeney, at ADP, that I always think back to. And I think, what would Chris Feeney do in this situation? Because he was a warm human being before he was a salesperson. And he was there to take care of his customer. That was his role in life. And I try and do that with my customers, and that's something I can feel good about. And I practiced the heck out of it. I belong to Toastmasters, and I practiced a lot of sales pitches in front of Toastmasters groups. Sorry, that was a really long answer, but it's a tough question.
Alex, once you start peeling back from a generic process on a project management methodology, do you also then delve into the subject matter expertise, whether it's pharmaceutical or data processing, and how do you kind of get up to speed on that to kind of pull the PM generic process to the particular area of subject matter expertise?
Yeah, this is an interesting thing, because I've seen people debate, do you need to be a subject matter expert, do you need to be a professional project manager? And that's something you could debate back and forth outside of the consulting question. And once you become a consultant, this is a really important question. Is your expertise and what makes you special, is it primarily your industry focus? Or is it primarily something else, something that crosses industry? And there's not a right or wrong answer there. For me, my niche is strategy. My niche is project management. My niche is making strategy happen. That's kind of my focus. And I'll do that for any industry. And I've worked for different industries. It surprised the heck out of me when I went in and a manufacturing company wanted to hire me. I thought I could only work in financial services because that was my background. But I realized it didn't matter. So it was almost, that's how I learned that I'm a multi-industry person. Is I got so much inquiry. I realized I've got a narrow focus. I've known other consultants, other people who all they do is lumberjacks. But they know the lumberjack industry inside and out. So they provide training, they provide consulting, they have sales products, they have physical products, but they know lumberjacking, and they'll never leave lumberjacking. So it depends on what you're, and that's where coming up with your business plan is so important. You need to start to think about those things. Because if you try and market to everybody, you'll get lost.
So then does that, if you put your business hat on, affect your per diem or your hourly rates that you would charge somebody, and how do you judge that? How do you calculate that?
Yeah, there's all sorts of nasty things that people say about rates for consultants, like, you just keep raising them until they scream. And that is legitimately a way to set your rates. It's a complicated question, setting your rates. What I did is I went out and I looked at other people who were performing similar types of work, and I tried to gather information about what they were charging. And I did, to some extent, focus the definition of what I was offering to people in order to make my rates competitive. Like, I don't know if any of you have gone out and you've just said, I'm a project manager, I'd like to go consult in your company. I'd like to be a daily or hourly project manager. My guess is, at least in New Jersey, it's somewhere like $65 an hour. That's not the lifestyle I'm looking for. On the other hand, if I come in and I say, you know, I know a strategy and I know how to make strategy happen, you can go up to hundreds of dollars an hour if you're a strategic expert. You won't work as much. You won't work full days for 12 months or 18 months. But it's a different kind of attitude and it's a different kind of business. And you can't sell to both markets. You have to decide what you are.
Thank you.
All right, I think you have a question. You can take your hand up a couple times.
So I like your elevator pitch. It was simple and clear. So can you tell us, without giving away any secrets, how you find these customers who have one of the two problems highlighted in your elevator pitch?
Well, it's funny. If you're looking out for clients, this is one of the funniest things. For a long time, I really struggled with, well, how do I go out and find clients? And I knew professional networking was going to be my primary way of finding clients. Because I like to speak. I like to do things like this. And I collect a lot of business cards over the years. So to some extent, I go through my business cards and I say, who do I know who might be a match? And sometimes I'll come up with new product ideas as a result of going through the list. I'll say, you know, I haven't done this yet, but this is something I could really do for this group. And then I'll try and develop that. So a lot of it I thought was going to come from the personal networking. Strangely, that has not panned out the way I thought it would. I briefly done some advertising, but I realized advertising did not work at all for me. I'm a real high-touch kind of salesperson. I'm somebody who most people trust when they meet me. They tend to trust me relatively quickly. So I need to be in front of people. I need to talk to them to really close sales. So what I began doing, and I resisted this at first, I found online chat areas have been a tremendous source of business for me. Which sounds horrible. You know, people say, where do you meet your clients? I say, I meet them online. But I've met a lot of my clients online. But what's neat about it is now with LinkedIn and professional discussion groups around project management and so on, they're places you can have really high, really in-depth conversations. And then people contact you afterwards and start to say, you know, hey, could you tell me a little more about this? And that leads to a real client discussion. But one of the people who I've talked to a lot, he really beat me up one time because I was trying all these different marketing techniques, and he asked me, Alex, where have you gotten your clients? I was like, I found them online. And I was so embarrassed. And he was like, Alex, if that works, go online more. You know, go into more discussion groups. Make sure you're doing that every week. And what I had been doing is getting so inside my head that this was the wrong way to find clients that I stopped going to the discussion group, which I loved and which were indeed finding the clients. So it's a strange thing. I would not say that's the right way to do it at all. But you can find a lot of experts out there who will give you a lot of different ideas. Ironically, I haven't seen any experts saying that you should be out in online discussion groups to find clients. I think I'm pretty unique in doing that. Let me hear him in the back.
What was your best experience and your worst experience as a consultant? If you'd like, you can use that as a conclusion of the presentation.
No. I'll tackle that now. The best thing, the best experience and the worst experience as a consultant. I think probably one of the best experiences is I had a chance to go out and work with an insurance company out in Baku, Azerbaijan. So, I don't know if everybody knows where Baku is, but it's on the Caspian Sea. Azerbaijan is south of Russia, south of Georgia, east of Armenia, and north of Iran. But it's really one of the warmest, most interesting countries I've ever spent any time in. And I got to work at an insurance company that was doing their claims register on spreadsheets and to help them convert it into a real computer system. And it was just remarkable. It was just so interesting to see, because I had heard from old-time claims people about how they used to do it by hand. But these guys weren't doing it by hand because they had Microsoft Office. So they had these strange spreadsheets, but it was kind of like the way it used to be done by hand, but with a little bit of automation flavor to it, and it was just so crazy and convoluted. But to go in and help with a situation like that was just, it was a lot of fun. And I got to use a little bit of my Russian, which was a lot of fun also. At least, thank goodness that 2 years in college didn't go for nothing. But, and then worst is, I think worst is probably that time I related in the beginning. Just sitting there and saying, how am I going to pay the mortgage? Because, you know, I'm a dad, 7 kids at home, sole breadwinner, 7 kids. So that weighs on me.
You are a good project manager.
You can imagine how many people think I'm nuts to go out on my own consulting. But in some ways, I think it's a more stable lifestyle than being an employee. It's not nearly as big a break as a lot of people think.
It's pretty good you could get your kids to go in the chat rooms for you.
No, I don't let my kids go in chat rooms. They go online somewhere.
Drum up some business.
But actually, my wife she's done some help for me in terms of the business, and she's probably going to do some more in the upcoming months. She's a better salesperson than I am. You had a question?
Do your clients expect measurable results? And if so, what typically are there in the dysfunctional versus overfunctional project management group?
This is one thing. How much of your results are measurable, and how much are they demanding around that? My strong preference, this is again part of my business model, is to give people fixed price contracts. So I'll come in and I'll say, for $10,000, I will do X for you, and this is what you'll get at the end. So in those cases, I mean, all they care about are the measurable results, because until I show them the measurable results, I can't submit a bill for them. So that's tended to be the way that I've done business. I do know a lot of other people who've built their consulting business on the other side, and they've said, no, I've got an expertise. It's up to them to come up with the strategy and other issues, but I will provide resources that they can use at an hourly rate. I don't know that one's better than the other, but for me, doing things in that fixed price manner, it makes sense to me. I'm very results oriented. I couldn't live with myself if I wasn't understanding the deliverable that I was providing to my clients. And even on things like teaching, I get assessed all the time numerically. The response cards that they get back, they go back and they look at my students and see whether they're actually able to apply the principles that I've tried to teach them. You better be producing results, in my advice.
In this over-functional, rigid process PMO group, what would be some of the success criteria for that? How do they know that they have reduced or brought enough flexibility?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, if there was the rigid PMO structure, first of all, I'd be taking it away pretty much. And I'd be changing probably a lot of their measures. Usually when I come in and I see a really rigid PMO group, most of their measures aren't business focused. So instead I turn them around and I look for things like production throughput, I look for customer satisfaction, I look for revenue growth, and I'm looking for changes in measures like that. And that's what I'm promising them. So when I write a proposal, that's what I'm focusing on. Which is the only way I can get past the defenders of the rigid PMO who don't want to take away any of the structure that's already there.
Right, because the structures, if it's process-focused, will be, did you do all the steps of inception or not?
Right.
As opposed to, how does their inception relate to the business?
Yeah. Okay. And those could be valid, depending on the contract that you were brought in on. Like, if I was brought in a situation where there was a need for an audit, then my measures might be along the lines of making sure that, you know, 80% of the time we follow this process from beginning to end. And that could be legitimate. But that's usually not what I'm doing, but it could be.
Okay. You mentioned contracts. I'm curious, do you write your own contracts, or do you have a template that you follow?
Yeah.
And either way, do you have an attorney review it before you?
I write my own contracts. So the question, do I write my own contracts, or I have a template? Do I go to an attorney? I don't go to an attorney. I've gone to an attorney to get some basic language. But but one of the things that I found is most of my clients, it will not be worth it to me to actually sue them to enforce the contract.
That's true.
So there's a lot of situations where I'm looking at this and I'm saying, you know, I'm putting out my time. I'll never get my time back if they don't pay. But I'm not doing contracts where I'm putting out a lot of capital, or where I'm doing a lot of capital investment, or where I'm turning over a lot of material to them. So I don't have to defend myself the way some companies would. It depends on your business whether you need something that's really strong and whether you're really going to take this to court. I tend to write things up in very much plain English. I do have some background in reviewing contracts in the past, and a lot of times I will sign the contract templates that my clients bring to me. If I have questions about them, I'll bring them to a lawyer, but usually I don't have a lot of questions about them.
So you gave examples in your elevator pitch about helping to define process. So I would imagine after a couple of things like that, you have some templates that you use. I mean, how do you consider that your intellectual property?
This is the best part. The best part about being a consultant as opposed to being an employee, when you create a template and you're an employee, who does it belong to?
The company.
The company, your employer. They own it. When you create it and you're a consultant, you have to write your contract this way. And this is one thing that I am very particular about in my contracts. When I create something for a client, it belongs to me except for the confidential and secret information that belongs to the client. So if the template belongs to me, the names of their projects and so on belongs to them. So I'll separate that out so that I can reuse that template in the future. And if anybody does insist that any of the templates I create remains theirs forevermore, that's a higher rate. It's a much higher rate. But I consider a lot of those kinds of things in there. And I love creating this stuff now. And I create a lot of stuff on my own time. You go on my website, alexsbrown.com, you'll find tons of templates and so on out there. And a lot of them I did create while I was an employee, but I was very careful about that. And if you're currently an employee and considering going out, be really, really careful around that. Do have a lawyer start to look at your employment contracts. If you've ever gotten an option grant, look at what you signed for the option grant, stock grants, anything like that. A lot of times there's something in there about non-compete or about the use of intellectual property. You really want to understand what's yours before you go out and try and build a business around it.
What kind of due diligence have you done to make sure that the templates you created, you know, haven't come from a good memory, you know, from looking at someone else's template?
One thing that's nice about me is I've purposely staked out areas where I don't like what anybody else has done in the past. No, but seriously, I went out and I bought every book I could find on strategic project management. I've got a shelf here, about 26 of them. And this is before I said I want to be the strategic project manager, I bought all these books. I looked at them and I said, I don't like this about this one, I don't like this about that one. Actually, Kent Crawford's one of the people who I really do like, and I like a lot of the things that he does, but he has a very different spin on things. I'll make sure I'm not going to take any of his templates or ideas or pictures and put them into my own work. Unless I'm crediting him. I mean, that's valid if I'm quoting him. But yeah, my advice is pick something that you can really have a unique voice in. And of course, you do watch out and make sure you're not reusing somebody else's stuff.
Non-competes, how do you deal with that?
I never had to sign a non-compete that influenced my particular business. I worked at Automatic Data Processing for a while. I did have to sign some non-competes there, but I don't provide processing services that would ever compete with ADP, and ADP's never provided consulting services. Merrill Lynch, I'm never going to be in the brokerage business. Mitsui Sumitomo, they didn't even actually have me do a lot of non-compete agreements in there. So along the way, if I were to start and now it's been several years since I worked there, usually there's a length of time that a non-compete can last. I'm the only employer that would really be a risk would be Mitsui Sumitomo, and they were very light in terms of needing non-competes. And they would never be concerned with anything I'm doing because they're primarily a Japanese
insurance company. I'm never going to enter the Japanese insurance market. They would never come after me.
But they don't ask you to not work with their competitors?
No, they don't. I've had them as a client, and they didn't. We had a small piece of business with Mitsui Sumitomo. If I went and worked with Tokyo Marine, which is a close competitor to Mitsui Sumitomo, I don't think they'd have an issue with that. Tokyo Marine actually might not want to work with me when they saw my resume, but I'm not sure how they feel about that. Japanese companies are different than U.S. companies. They're less bound by the legalistic issues. They're more bound by the relationship issues. So it's different kind of attitude. But I've been lucky that way. If you work for a consulting company, though, this is going to be a much bigger concern because that might keep you out of certain types of businesses that you might want to do. I think we're going to have to wrap up soon, but let me take your question.
How long is your typical engagement?
Let's see. My longest so far has been about 12 weeks, and my shortest is a two-day training class. I've had some that were only a couple of hours of consulting online, so that would probably be my shortest. I've also done some product stuff too, where I'm developing products, DVDs and things like that.
And typical engagement?
Typical engagement? I don't think I really have a typical engagement. That's part of my problem. I need more engagements. All right, let me start to wrap up. First, one thing I just want to get out of the way is your. In front of you, you have a sign-up sheet. I have a newsletter and some different information that I put out on a regular basis. If you're interested in receiving the newsletter, just take this form, write your name and email address. Write your email address, sign your name at the top. Put your business card in here and wrap it around. Put it in any of the bowls up here. I'll get you on my email list. Now, if any of you find this stuff interesting and you think, well, maybe I want to get involved in some of this, I've got this DVD that I put together about how to put together a project charter. It really doesn't matter whether you're going to stay an employee or whether you're going to go out on the consulting area. This is good information to know. I use these ideas all the time when I'm doing initial contracts, initial project proposals. Essentially, it's the same thing. A project proposal is a charter. So this DVD will give you a lot of useful ideas about how to write charters. That's $40. So you can check off on this. If you want to pay for it now, that's fine. If you want me to bill you later, check off, bill me later. Either way, just take the DVD. I believe you. I trust you. And finally, I know there's going to be some of you out here who are thinking, I really want to do this consulting thing. I know I can help you past problems that I ran into, past struggles I ran into. Check the box that says, I want to be a consultant, contact you later. I've got some different product offerings, consulting offerings, where I can actually help you through some of the early phases, and maybe even decide that you don't want to be a consultant for various reasons. But I can give you a lot more detail than I've been able to give you in the last hour. So if anybody has any questions about this or anything else, too, just grab me afterwards. But I wanted to leave you guys with one last final thought. When I went at Sydney with the panel of all the hyper-experienced consultants, I think you'd probably back me up on this, too. If I asked them, what's the one thing that you love about consulting? What's the best thing about consulting? And you went down the line, and they all answered this a little bit differently, but it all really came down to one idea. It was freedom. Their world was their own. What they were going to get up and do tomorrow morning was up to them. They reported to themselves. And that kind of freedom, I don't know how else you get it, but it's a really unique thing. And anybody who tells you it's only available in America is that's ridiculous. These folks were from the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. It's available all over the world. But it's really only available if you find it for yourself and if you take responsibility for it. So I hope some of you are inspired to become consultants. I hope some of you are shaking your heads and saying, I'll never do that. I'm sorry I was even thinking about it. Either way, I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.